Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking about a topic today that is central to all of our lives, and yet something that hardly ever gets examined in a really serious way, particularly not in the way that it is explored by author Mary Otto. We're talking about teeth, our teeth, caring for our teeth, and more central to the discussion today, how there is a vast disparity, particularly in America, between those who can easily afford to lavish great attention on their teeth and those for whom even the most basic sort of dental care might be very sadly out of reach. And why is that? And why do we approach dental care so differently from the healthcare system that attends to the rest of our bodies? It is almost as though the teeth are not part of the body when it comes to the way we deliver so-called healthcare and then dental care, kind of off to the side, delivered in very different fashion. Mary Otto's book shows us some historical perspective on this. And not only is she speaking about kind of a vast cultural canvas, but she is also highlighting the experiences of various individuals, and in some cases, the terrible suffering of certain individuals who, for one reason or another, have endured a terrible ordeal and have not had the help that some of the rest of us pretty much take for granted. The title of the book is Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. Mary Otto is the oral health topic leader for the Association of Healthcare Journalists, and she has written extensively about this for the Washington Post for the last few years. Her book is published by the New Press. Mary Otto, we welcome you to the morning show.
I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you.
I am excited for this opportunity, and I'm so glad you wrote this book. Could I ask you about this item in your biography that I just read off to our listeners, that you are the oral health topic leader for the Association of Healthcare Journalists? What's wrapped up in that description, and what does that work have to do with the crafting of this book?
Well, it's been a real interesting opportunity for me. The Association of Healthcare Journalists is a group where they're based in Missouri. And it's a group for health writers and journalists from all over the country and all over the world. And we have a conference once a year, but most of the time we just communicate with each other, you know, online and support each other in our work. And as an oral health topic leader, I write a weekly blog for, you know, my fellow journalists about dental and oral health issues, you know, research, news. I curate resources. We host, you know, webinars and have panel discussions and things about topics related to dental care and oral health. And most of the journalists in our group are very busy. You know, they're doing all kinds of work, you know, whether they're radio reporters or newspaper reporters or freelance, you know, writers. But I try to keep dental and oral health issues, you know, on their radar screens as they go about their work. So they think of dental care and oral health when they're out on their beats and looking for stories and doing their work.
Mm. You are pointing to something you're pointing to something so important there that comes up repeatedly in your book, namely that when we talk about health care issues and medical issues, we are so quick to not include dental care in the mix. It's as though we're too busy talking about preventing heart attacks and all kinds of other disorders and illnesses and diseases, that it almost doesn't dawn on us to include dental care and dental health in that same conversation. Explain to our listeners, in a sense, where this divide began. It's a divide that's been in place for quite a long time, as you explain in your book.
Yeah, and it's so odd that something that happened long ago would, you know, still affect our daily lives in this interesting way. But I guess, you know, when you think about history, that's the way history works. I found out, and like I am a Washington, D.C. based reporter, but when I worked at the Washington Post, I covered Maryland mostly. I covered social issues and health care, housing, poverty, all kinds of things. But that's where I got started on this project. I found out that the story of dentistry as a separate profession had its origins in Baltimore in 1840. And that's where the first dental college in the world opened. And the story of its creation became the creation story of dentistry in this country. And as the story's told, the founders of the school were two dentists. They were more or less self-trained dentists. They worked as, you know, they got their skills through just following the example of experienced practitioners. But, you know, there was no professional, you know, it was kind of considered a trade in those days. But their names were Horace Hayden and Chapin Harris. And they thought dentistry deserved to be thought of as a profession, not as just something that anybody who said they could do it, and, you know, at the time blacksmiths did it, barbers did it. So they approached the physicians at the College of Medicine at the University of Maryland with the idea of adding dental instruction to the medical courses there. And the physicians, as the story goes, rejected that proposal, and they said the subject of dentistry is of little consequence, and sort of sent these two dental practitioners on their way, and they started their own dental college. But that event is remembered as the historic rebuff, and it's seen as a symbolic event, but it also has had real consequences, and it continues to define this relationship and the system, you know, that we have, the separate system. Dentists still drill and fill teeth, and physicians still tend to look at the body from the tonsils south. And, you know, it's and it affects how we look at our own selves, our own bodies and mouths.
I want to take a moment and have you explain one of the most intriguing passages in the book, which is where you talk about the human mouth and, of course, the teeth that that the mouth contains. At one point, you say, the oral cavity is a dark cabinet full of wonders. It comprises many and varied environments, washed by healing fluid, lined by shining purple mucosa. It is inhabited by organisms as numerous as the citizens of Earth. More than 600 species of bacteria live there, some as yet to be named. The mouth sustains life. The digestive process begins there. Its glands and ducts produce disease-fighting saliva and lymph. You go on to a little later in that same chapter to talk about the mouth being an ecosystem as vital and vulnerable as a coral reef. Explain why this is an important matter for us to embrace and remember. I mean, in what way is it helpful for us to think about the human mouth in this way?
Well, you know, it's funny. We still have sort of a sense that, okay, and it dates back to the old days when, you know, before science had advanced to this point that we, you know these things that I tried to describe in those lines that you read, you know, that if you get a decayed tooth, you go to the dentist and he drills it and fills it, or she drills it and fills it, and there's the problem solved. But tooth decay is actually a symptom of, you know, this complex, you know, chronic disease that's the most prevalent chronic disease in children and adults in America, and we're finding out more about what causes it and how we can prevent it and how we can heal it, and it's just the tip of the iceberg, you know, what I tried to explain there about what scientists are finding out about our oral health and how important it is and how delicate it is that we, you know, we need to think about oral health and disease as the important phenomena that they are. And I just think if we had a fuller and deeper appreciation of those things, we wouldn't be so, oral health wouldn't be so easily left out of the conversation, you know, when we talk about health care and health. We need to overcome that dualistic way we think about it.
Right.
So yeah, that was what I was trying to, I mean, you could write a whole book just about the amazing things they're learning about oral health and disease. I met this paleoanthropologist at Harvard named Tanya Smith, and she's unlocked the mysteries of ancient lives through looking at dental enamel. She says we have this faithful clock in our mouths, and in the layers of our enamel, we actually have a neonatal line that marks the moment of our birth. So she can trace, like, it's like the rings in a tree. She can trace, you know, the time and experience of people's lives and ancient, you know, lives, even back to the Neanderthal times, by reading these lines in the enamel. It's just such amazing stuff.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Mary Otto, talking about her book, Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. And we will explain some of what is part of that subtitle very, very shortly, because a big part of Mary Otto's book is about, in a sense, a country of haves and have-nots when it comes to dental care and access to dental care. We've already touched on the fact that there was this intriguing divide that occurred in the early 1840s in Baltimore when these two gentlemen who wanted, in a sense, the world of dentistry to become more serious and more scientifically based, and in a sense based more in the system of healthcare, tried to get their new medical, their dental school attached to a medical college, and apparently were rebuffed, and that helped set the stage for this sort of dual world in which the world of dental care exists to such a surprising extent apart from the world of overall medical care. In that historical long view that you give us, you also tell a really fascinating story about how we began to finally understand where dental decay came from, namely, of course, from germs and microbes. And that set off a whole series of actions that were in some senses quite excessive and maybe created as many problems as they solved. Ahead of explaining that, before we understood what caused tooth decay and other issues in the mouth, what was the presumption before that? I mean, before scientific know-how was brought to bear, was serious thought even given to why people get cavities and why people have to have teeth extracted? Did people just guess? I mean, what was the presumption before this became a bit more scientifically based?
Well, there were always, you know, theories. I mean, one popular theory was that there were tiny worms, you know, you've called tooth worms, that burrowed in and decayed the teeth. And, you know, some people thought even back in the days of Hippocrates, people had theories, oh, hot and cold caused diseases of all kinds and affected the teeth, the humoral theory, you know, that there were these large kind of ecological forces that, you know, were at work, you know, both outside and inside our bodies. And, you know, it wasn't until scientists figured out that, you know, microbes, you know, including bacteria, you know, had a causal, you know, role in all kinds of diseases, including tooth decay, that they started to zero in on, you know, what actually causes tooth decay.
Explain what that discovery or realization set off in dental offices across the country in the early part of the 20th century. This is an amazing story I did not know anything about.
Yeah, this was, I mean, luckily we're a little bit too young to remember this, but yeah, early in the 20th century, it was quite the rage. It was called the focal theory of disease, and it was for like four decades. Many doc physicians were convinced that the mouth, and including restored teeth, were the source of almost every human malady you could imagine. Everything from hiccups to madness to dementia to cancer were, they believe, caused by bacteria that migrated from the mouth and had spread to different parts of the body. So a widely accepted solution was to extract all the teeth. You know, they called it total clearance. Sometimes they would also remove the tonsils, you know, and unfortunately, all these diseases persisted, you know, even as people were left toothless. And thankfully, with the dawning of antibiotics and more sophisticated kinds of research, this theory was finally abandoned. But in the meantime, millions and millions of teeth were needlessly extracted.
Right.
Not just in the United States, but, you know, in other countries as well.
You describe the attitude of a certain dentist by the name of Willoughby D. Miller, who apparently was one of the key figures in sort of galvanizing this approach. You write, Miller began to see the mouth as the vector for all manner of human suffering. For him, the mouth was not just a passive portal for illness. Miller saw it as an active reservoir for disease, a dark, wet incubator where virulent pathogens were able to multiply. A little later in the chapter, you say it was seen by many as the human mouth seen as a veritable cesspool. It's so interesting, first of all, to read about that, and then to realize that with every good intention, it is possible to take a little bit of information and spin it into something that becomes truly counterproductive. And this is probably a very valuable cautionary tale that makes this story very important to retell.
Yeah, you still hear it mentioned once in a while in exactly that way, as a cautionary tale when you go to, you know, oral health and medical conferences. You know, be careful. We've got to be very careful, you know, as we go forward with our research. And now those same microorganisms are being examined, you know, and people are studying them in as consortia. You know, they're studying their relationships, and not so quick to say this one is a bad one, this one's a good one. It's more about the balance, you know, looking at the mouth as an ecosystem, or a system of ecosystems even.
Before we talk about the disparity in dental care, which is such an important part of your book. I wonder if you could just say a word about some of the ways in which dental care has entered the 21st century in such exciting fashion, with various kinds of breakthroughs that, to some extent at least, have been revolutionary in the way that we care for our teeth and the way in which issues that arise with our teeth are dealt with.
Well, some researchers have even suggested, you know, that it might be useful to think about, well, one leading researcher, at least in the early, at the very turn of this century we're living in now, suggested that you might be able to think about oral disease as a kind of ecological catastrophe, you know, that there's a shift in balance within the mouth that makes decay more likely. And, I mean, of course, this is all going on at a very high level of research, but just the understanding that of how our teeth remineralize themselves and over the course of the day, you know, that our saliva kind of washes and buffers our teeth, and when we brush our teeth, we disrupt the workings of the microbes, which is, you know, a good thing in a lot of ways, there's a balance, a pH balance that can either assist decay in its progression or inhibit decay. You know, oral hygiene habits are important in this, in keeping our teeth healthy and our mouths healthy. That water fluoridation, community water fluoridation projects across the country have helped, you know, a lot over the since World War II to bring, you know, the decay fighting properties of fluoride to people's water, their drinking water, you know, all this awareness, you know, this, you know, really high level research also filters into the way we are care for ourselves and you know, our teeth.
Mm. One of my most powerful memories of sitting in a dentist chair was something that occurred, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, when for the first time my own dentist, whose name, by the way, is Kind, Dr. Kind, put into my mouth something that seemed like a standard dental tool, but in fact, it was a camera of sorts, and she could move this device around my mouth, and there on a screen, I could see, in a sense, what she was seeing, my own teeth magnified many, many, many times over. And to me, it was one of the most, you know, sort of powerful experiences, transformative experiences I think I've ever had, because most of us never get to see our teeth in that respect, and maybe we're shown the x-rays of our teeth, but that's not at all the same thing as just seeing them as though, you know, it's a drone camera flying over a mountain range, except it's our own teeth, including you know, all that's beautiful about them and all that's imperfect. But one really gets a sense of, in a sense, this landscape in the mouth and our teeth, and I don't know, at least for me, it really made it clear how important it was for me to take proper care of my teeth. And of course, that's the kind of thing that would not have been possible 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. It's a less of a superficial look, a deeper look.
So your book is, of course, as much as anything, concerned with the vast inequality that exists in our country in terms of the access to dental care that various people have, whether it is a matter of not being able to afford it, and in some cases not being able to find it, with certain parts of the country that in which there are very, very serious shortages. One of the intriguing choices you make in talking about this overall topic is that you seize upon a couple of different people with very, very different stories. One of them is a contestant in a beauty pageant, and her story of her encounter with dental care is quite intriguing. T- Tell our listeners about her and why you wanted to include her story here.
Let's, you know, cosmetic dentistry is a huge facet of you know, what we think of as dental care in this country. So it seemed important to explore someone who really put a high value on having perfect teeth. And I thought, well, I'll someone who's competing in beauty pageants would certainly probably be able to tell that story. So I went to the Miss Maryland USA pageant, and I was actually surprised to find out when the winner was announced that one of the prizes she won, in addition to, you know, new gowns and shoes and jewelry and eyelash extensions, was $10,000 worth of cosmetic dental treatments. And, you know, this was a woman who was already beautiful and perfect enough to win the Miss Maryland USA pageant, but, you know, she wins this additional prize of dental care in order to go on and compete in the Miss USA pageant, where she'd be on, you know, the national stage. And so her name is Mame Ajay, and she did accept this prize and went ahead and got, you know, Invisalign braces and teeth whitening, and she got her gums contoured to make her teeth look a little bit longer, you know, all in you know, with the goal of being even more perfect than she already was to be, you know, to compete as for Miss USA. And, you know, she let me follow her through, you know, her process of her care, and it was such an unfamiliar territory for me, you know, as someone who's written a lot about public health and, you know, kind of basic routine dental care, to be, you know, following someone through this cosmetic regime that she went through.
Right. Well, and of course, it was a regime, a gauntlet that was not particularly pleasant. I mean, in more ways than one, it was an uncomfortable process for her. And not just physically, but in a sense, emotionally and mentally as well. In fact, at one point, she talked about feeling like she was someone's art project. And one gets a sense that she ultimately found the experience of undergoing this quite disconcerting and maybe deeply troubling.
Well, you know, any kind of the oral health and dental care are very intimate things there. They're going on in your mouth, and, you know, you're in such a sensitive area of your body. And, of course, she was under all kinds of pressure, too, to get ready for this pageant. I can't even imagine, you know, the kind of stress people must go through, you know, when they're preparing to be judged in this way. So I'm sure, you know, I'm sure that it was a difficult time for her, and she always carried herself with such grace that I, you know, this wasn't something she would have shown publicly, but I'm grateful she allowed me to spend the time with her when she was going through it.
You actually, in the course of this chapter, make an interesting observation about professional dentistry and photography, that in a sense, photography and professional dentistry were born at precisely the same moment in history. And you go on to say, the disciplines have enjoyed a complex and synergistic relationship ever since. Explain what that interesting relationship has been.
Yeah, I was really surprised to find out that, you know, the year that dental college was founded, you know, in 1840, was also the year that the first U.S. patent was awarded for a camera, and it was described as an item for making likenesses, and the patent was awarded to a dentist. And then soon afterwards, photographic negatives were introduced, and that made photographs kind of infinitely reproducible. And the photograph held up a new mirror for us to examine ourselves, and it also, you know, since it was reproducible, kind of set new standards for beauty. And, you know, over the years, the rest of the 19th century, you know, brought us even the first moving pictures. And by the early 20th century, we had talking pictures, you know, movies with sound. And then the actors started, you know, opening their mouths and talking. And by the Great Depression, you know, people were flocking to the movies for, you know, by the millions. We were just trying to find some little bit of comic relief or escape from our daily sorrows. And that is actually where the cosmetic dental phenomenon we have today was born. There was a young dentist named Charles Pincus who went to the movies as well, and he looked up onto the screen and saw that some of these actors didn't have very attractive teeth, and he invented these small snap-on appliances. They came to be known as Hollywood veneers, and many, many actors and actresses used his services. Even little Shirley Temple wore his veneers. You know, she became a movie star when she was just 6 years old, and we never saw her lose her baby teeth. She always had this perfect little pearly set of teeth, thanks to Dr. Pincus. And the cosmetic dental boom took off. You know, of course, people wanted to look like movie stars. And in the 1980s, new products, you know, made dental veneers much more popular, you know, not snap-on veneers, but the kind of veneers people actually have attached to their teeth. And medical credit cards came along in the 90s, which allows people to, you know, pay for these procedures even if they don't have the cash. You know, they're elective procedures, so, you know, it's not like your insurance covers these things. So yeah, this is huge. It's like part of the whole self-improvement craze that goes along with, you know, tummy tucks and all kinds of other cosmetic procedures that people seek out to make themselves more perfect.
In stark contrast to the story of this beauty contestant, there is a very tragic story about a young boy by the name of Demonte Driver. Yeah. Some of our listeners might possibly recognize that name, but for the sake of those who don't, explain the place of Demonte Driver in your book. Explain the heart and soul of his tragic story.
Well, his story is what really got me started on this. And it was 10 years ago. I was working at the Washington Post as a, you know, on the Metro desk and covering social issues. And I found myself standing beside his hospital bed, and it turned out he was dying of the complications of untreated tooth decay. And this was like 2007, and doctors told his mother that bacteria from this dental abscess he had in one of his teeth had spread to his brain, and he'd received two brain surgeries. He stayed in the hospital for about 6 weeks. His care cost a quarter of $1 million, but ultimately he died. And he was a poor Medicaid child, you know, and Medicaid, most Medicaid children, even today, although progress has been made since Diamante died and his story caused such a national and state uproar and call for reform. But still, fewer than half of Medicaid children get routine care, and roughly a third of our country, a third of Americans face significant barriers getting dental care. So Diamante was just a reminder of the vast lack of access to routine care for so many Americans in some ways.
Well, and it was a story in which we maybe learned in a vivid way that we had not before, that when someone does not receive proper care for a dental issue that is this serious, the result can be death, not just discomfort or disfigurement, but death of a 12-year-old.
So, yeah, the decade that he died, there was a study that was done. There were 61,000 hospitalizations for abscess teeth, and researchers found that 66 people had died of those people who'd been hospitalized. Another study has found that over 1 million people go to emergency rooms every year for toothaches and other things, and those visits cost more than $1 billion to our healthcare system. And during the recession, one study found there, during 3 years in the recent recession, 101 patients died of those emergency room visits. Thankfully, these dental deaths are far more rare than in the days before we had antibiotics and things, but they still happen. They really do.
You point out that for the poor of this country, so many of them are, in essence, forced to endure all kinds of suffering when it comes to their teeth, and really terrible dental issues that can include very, very painful toothaches and sleeplessness and the loss of teeth, and that in so many respects, when we look at somebody and when we look at their mouth, when we look at their teeth, that can be, in a strange sort of way, a marker of someone's economic well-being. And there is something very, very sad and unfair about that.
Yeah, there really is. I mean, we look at oral health through kind of a moral lens. You know, you think, oral disease disfigures people. You know, if you're missing your teeth and you're afraid to smile and you're ashamed of yourself and the way you look, you're stigmatized. You're somewhat depersonalized. And even though you may be one of the millions of Americans who doesn't really have access to routine care and may have missed out on having routine preventive care when you were young and you're still living with the consequences as an adult, you have a harder time finding a job or advancing socially or economically. I mean, it can really condemn you to the cycle of poverty and to suffer from oral disease and missing teeth. And we judge people who suffer in ways we may not be so quick to judge people who suffer from other kinds of disease, too.
Right. One of the things you point out in your book is that not only are we talking about dental care that is out of the easy reach of many people because of its cost or because of the limits of something like Medicaid, but you also point to a really serious shortage of dentists, particularly in certain parts of the country. Just how serious a shortage are we talking about?
Well, there are federal statistics to show, and federal people, researchers who map this, that they've designated over 5,000 areas, communities in this country as dental professional shortage areas, and those communities are home to more than 49 million Americans. And some of them are in rural places, you know, where you might drive, you know, miles and miles to see to find a dentist. Some of them are in, you know, urban places where there are just not enough providers to meet the needs, you know, of the population. But yeah, it's a significant problem. You know, people might travel for miles, or they might wait for very long times to find to get an appointment with a provider. So yeah, it's a serious, especially someone who takes their insurance. It's particularly difficult for people on public insurance, like, you know, Medicaid, because fewer than half of dentists participate in Medicaid. They complain the reimbursement rates are too low and the paperwork is burdensome. So for people on public insurance, those barriers are even higher, you know, than someone who might have private insurance and who's living in a provider shortage area.
Right. One of the things you point out is that there have been certain efforts underway in certain parts of the country to allow dental hygienists to sort of get into some of these high-need areas and perform some of the functions that we might think of being done more by dentists. And you write of how dentists, at least as a whole, have been extremely resistant to the notion of dental hygienists being allowed to do more extensive work without being under the direct supervision of a dentist. First of all, what is going on there? What is it that dental hygienists might be able to do in terms of their training, and what is it that is fueling the dentists' reluctance to allow that to go forward?
There's been a long history behind this, and I was really interested to find out about it. You know, the profession of dental hygiene was created back in the, you know, progressive era, early in the 20th century, and it was one of those things where this dentist was, you know, exploring ways to prevent disease, and he went to a lecture and found out, you know, if you routinely, you know, clean the teeth and you know, take care of them and, you know, and teach patients about proper nutritional habits and home care, you know, you could reduce tooth decay. And he was really excited about this. His name was Alfred Fones, and he lived in Connecticut, and he went back to his office and he trained his chairside assistant to do some of these procedures and ended up starting a school for, you know, to train young ladies to do this kind of work and work, you know, not just in dental offices, but they went out to schools and he served on the school board for a while, and he'd bring children in to see public officials and say, you know, look at these children. They need dental care. We need to have hygienists in the school teaching them how to take care of their teeth. And he got dental hygienists into the schools. They worked in factories. They went out to Bridgeport, Connecticut was a sort of a center of during World War I, you know, a munitions center and a port city. So the hygienists went and examined the soldiers who were based there and gave them toothbrushes and things like that. And over the years, after World War I, there was kind of a reaction and kind of a fear of socialism and communism and socialized medicine. And the American, you know, organized medicine and organized dentistry kind of fought back against state medicine, and the school clinics were closed. Then World War II comes, and thousands and thousands of young men who were drafted to serve were found to be dental cripples because they had such poor oral health. So after the war, Congress went back to look at the disparities in care again and started talking again about expanding, finding ways to expand care to more people and get, you know, broaden federal efforts to get care out to people. But organized medicine and organized dentistry kind of fought back and said, you know, the providers need to have autonomy, you know, they defended the private practice system and their own control of the marketplace. And this issue has continued. I mean, I met a dental hygienist named Tammy Bird from South Carolina, and the state had changed its law just in recent years to get care to a quarter of a million children, poor kids around South Carolina who were just not getting routine care. And one of the initiatives the state officials wanted to employ was to get dental hygienists out into these schools. I mean, little children can't get themselves to a dentist, neither can nursing home patients. They were trying to find ways to get the care to the people who needed it. And Tammy Byrd was a hygiene leader in the state. She was very excited and when this law was passed, and she mortgaged her house and set up a company to sort of get hygienists into these schools that wanted the care. And the state dental board fought back and got an emergency regulation put into effect to stop the hygienists. And, you know, they said, oh, this is substandard care. You know, we can't have this. The Federal Trade Commission took Tammy Byrd's case and won it, and she's back out there now with the other hygienists visiting these schools. But, you know, in many states, hygienists have worked for more autonomy, and in some cases they have met very strong resistance from organized dentistry.
So where do you see this headed, particularly in this new environment in which there is the possibility of the Affordable Health Care Act being repealed and or replaced by some alternative that has yet to really fully take shape? But in this current environment, are you feeling optimistic, or are you feeling more concerned about where all of these issues are headed?
You know, I'm just watching it all really closely. You know, Medicare, from its start, has never included routine dental benefits. So millions of seniors, you know, retirees are dentally uninsured. Medicaid entitles children to care, although many of them don't receive it. And adults' benefits under Medicaid are left up to the states. The Children's Health Insurance Program, which covers the children of the working poor, didn't originally guarantee dental benefits, although after Diamante died, the state delegation fought in Congress to get a dental benefit guaranteed in CHIP, so I'm waiting to see what happens with CHIP's, you know, with CHIP in the next few months or years. You know, I'm listening to hear if oral health gets mentioned in all these discussions, and you have to listen very, very closely and watch very closely to see if it will be. And I think it's becoming more, there's a growing awareness, though, that it does belong in all discussions about health care, whether it's, you know, when you're going, taking yourself to the doctor or the dentist, or in our great discussions as a nation about what health benefits really mean and what they should cover. You know, I'm hoping and listening for dental care to be included in these discussions.
So that we finally stop thinking about proper dental care as a luxury and think of it as more of a necessity for someone living a healthy and happy life. Well, we certainly are given a lot to think about in your fascinating book, which again is titled Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. It's published by The New Press. The author, Mary Otto. Mary Otto, thank you so much for writing a really important book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I am so glad we had this opportunity.
I'm so grateful for your time, Greg, and really glad to be with you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'll be speaking with someone who is a special guest at Carthage College for the next couple of days, higher education journalist Mary Beth Markline, and we'll be talking with her about the latest trends in higher education both here and around the world. She also cares deeply about the importance of journalism, high-quality journalism, in a democratic society, so we'll have a lot to talk about in that regard as well. On Wednesday, I have conversations with two musicians, beginning with a young cellist by the name of Matthew Udry, the most recent winner of the Racine Symphony Youth Competition. He is about to play with the Racine Symphony for their concert this coming weekend, music of Dvorak from his marvelous cello concerto. Also, a conversation with pianist David Newman on the faculty of Beloit College, who plays this weekend with the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. And on Thursday, we will preview